Mon Mothma might have disagreed, but she was no soldier. General Merrick, too, might have disagreed, but he had led Blue Squadron through the gate to Scarif. And now, Starfighter Command fell to Raddus as well.
What's going on down there, Lieutenant?
Raddus called.
Unknown, sir, came the reply. The shield jams all communications!
Raddus swore to himself. Victory in Scarif's orbit meant nothing if Rogue One failed.
We've got to buy Urso and her team some time, he said. Throw our weight at those Star Destroyers and let's start probing that shield.
If the Alliance was lucky, Urso had an exfiltration route already planned. If not, the burden was on Raddus.
Yes, sir,
he heard, and kept his eyes in their steady rotation between viewport and tactical displays. A wing of Red Squadron fighters strafed the orbital gate station, maneuvering among clusters of sensor towers and laser turrets. The attack did little damage, but inflicting damage hadn't been the goal. The fighters had claimed the station gunner's attention, left a few turbo laser platforms in burning ruin, and given Gold Squadron's Y-Wings the opportunity for a bombing run. The impacts of the Y-Wing's proton torpedoes winked out the viewport even as the scanners revealed swarms of TIE fighters pouring from the station hangars. The command ships were faring better against the Star Destroyers. Any single vessel in the Rebel fleet compared poorly with the Empire's mighty warships. But Raddus, speaking only a word here and there, kept the destroyers boxed in, unable to turn their full firepower on one target without exposing a flank to concentrated volleys. It was, in a sense, a delaying tactic, but delay defeat long enough, and a triumph might eventually find its way home.
Sir!
The lieutenant again.
Enemy fighters coming in!
Red and Gold squadrons were busily engaged against the gate or the destroyers. Pulling them back to defend the profundity was no option worth considering.
Withdraw to 50,000 kilometers from the shield gate, Raddus said. Stay in the TIE fighters' range, but force them to stretch their line. If they don't think to regroup, the point defense gunners can handle the bulk of them.
Even as he spoke, the profundity shields coruscated with energy as cannon fire struck home. The ship rumbled and its generators strained, but it could hold. Another X-Wing blinked out of existence on the tactical display. Then another. A Rebel freighter desperately evading TIE fire skimmed the Scarif shield until its hull crumpled and its burning components rolled and bounced across the energy field. One of the hammerheads, caught between the two Star Destroyers, momentarily lost its overtaxed deflectors and signaled for help as turbo lasers left blackened, burning holes in its sides. Raddus observed the carnage patiently and waited for an opportunity to change the course of the battle. Waited for an insight that he could apply with the precision of a knife. He thought again about the dead and how Mothma and Merrick might react. Maybe humans felt loss more keenly. They spawned so rarely and so few. His own grandchildren numbered in the dozens. And though he loved each, he knew some would never come of age. The death of individuals was no tragedy in battle. It was the death of hundreds that would haunt him. He listened to cries of despair on the starfighter's frequency, and an anguished scream as Red 5 was torn apart. The profundity shields flashed constantly now. The chatter among the bridge crew members was growing louder and more frantic.
We're having no effect on the shield gate, the lieutenant said, and we're sustaining heavy losses, Admiral.
I'm aware,
Raddus said, and he was. But the state of the battle had not changed. He had to assume Ursa was still on the ground, still working to obtain the Death Star schematics that would reveal the weakness she'd promised. He could not withdraw. He could expect no Allied reinforcements. His fleet was crewed by the best officers the Rebellion could provide. He waited for opportunity, for insight, for an error. Then he saw it, and cried order so swiftly it seemed to stun the crew.
All ships nearby! Close to support the Heartbound and Deviant! Match current trajectories! Demand that destroyer's attention!
one of the Star Destroyers had allowed itself to be flanked on two sides while leaving its forward firing arc empty. Its weapons had been almost entirely diverted to port and starboard. Raddus was ready to shout another command, but Gold Squadron recognized the opening and he heard a voice on the comm.
Y-wing's on me! Path is clear!
The bomber wing, barely out of its last attack run against the shield gate, altered course and powered directly toward the exposed front of the destroyer. TIE fighters pursued, faster than the bombers, but unprepared to pull away from the defense of the gate. The destroyer itself recognized the danger, attempted to swing away and simultaneously bring its guns to bear, but far too late. The Y-wings converged and flew so close to the Imperial vessel that the tactical displays couldn't differentiate them from the destroyer's mass.
Ion torpedoes away,
the wing leader declared. Raddus called up a visual and watched the Y-wings climb out of the attack, illuminated by bright electric bursts that crawled across the destroyer's surface. Lightning silently ravaged Imperial deflector dishes and weapon emplacements. The glow of mighty ion engines went dark.
They're down, sir!
The lieutenant called.
The destroyer has lost power!
Press the attack, Raddus said,
calm as ever.
Maintain fire against the remaining destroyer, but divert available ships to the orbital station. Let's see how much the shield gate can take.
Now the state of the battle had changed, but time was still working against them. Sooner or later, Imperial reinforcements would come. Rebels would continue to die.
What are you doing, Rogue One?
Tonk had insisted on dispersing his troops around the landing pad.
If you get caught out there, we're not going to do any good guarding the shuttle. You say you need to talk to the fleet to get the data tape off-world? Fine. That means we protect you like we would the tape.
Bodhi had tried to argue, but he'd mumbled only a few words before Tonk's people had hurried out.
Wait for our signal,
Tonk had said, gripping Bodhi tight by the shoulder.
When the way is clear, run fast as you can.
Then he too had gone. Now Bodhi adjusted the straps of the cable spool, looking out from the boarding ramp and listening to the thunder of starfighters overhead. A momentary fancy put him in a world where he'd scored higher, much higher, at the Imperial Flight Academy. A world where he'd been assigned to TIE duty, and where he was the one shooting at invading X-Wings on Scarif. His mouth was dry and his heart was pounding. He wasn't a soldier. One of the rebels gave a hand signal from across the landing pad. Bodhi ran. Heat hit him like a wall. Not just the heat of the sun, but the hot flecks carried by the smoke of the battle. The shuttle had filtered out the worst of it before. Now Bodhi felt sweat dampen his flight suit, had to breathe open-mouthed to draw in enough of the stinking air. Each impact of his boots on metal jostled the spool on his back, caused the straps to slip a little lower until he was fumbling to right them as he moved. He'd meant to keep his head down to avoid being spotted, but he couldn't stay low and manage the spool at the same time. He could only hope that no one but Tonk and the rebels was watching. He turned a corner around a stack of cargo crates and crouched beside the network console. He didn't take the time to look around. He tugged the end of the cable in one hand, slammed it into place, and stayed in position only as long as it took for the console to register and accept the connection. After that, he spun about and charged back the way he'd come. His legs were already sore, but each step became easier as the cable unspooled behind him. He was almost at the shuttle when he was suddenly jerked back. He nearly lost his balance, stumbled around, and saw that the spool had run out.
No.
He checked the length beforehand. He'd been careful, which meant the cable had snagged somewhere, probably on one of the cargo crates. He almost laughed. He saved the energy for the run. With cable wriggling behind him, still attached to his back, he retraced his steps until he found the kink, as he'd expected, under the corner of a crate. He knelt to prise out the cable, intending to run it over the crate to give him the extra length he needed. He didn't get the chance.
Hey, you!
An electronic voice called. Bodhi squeezed the cable tight in his hands.
Identify yourself!
He unclenched his hands and let the cable drop. He stood slowly and faced the stormtrooper closest to him as others nearby observed.
I can explain,
he started, but he never got a chance to finish. Red blaster bolts flashed around him, and the stormtrooper staggered and fell. The stream of bolts didn't stop, however. Bodhi dropped to his knees and saw more troopers racing toward the landing pad, firing in the direction of Tonk and his men. He lifted the cable again and looked toward the shuttle. It seemed as far away as the Citadel or the stars. The broad shaft of the data vault rose half a dozen stories inside the Citadel. In the center of the shaft stood multiple towers of stacked data banks, each bank aglow with dim red light indicating the storage status of 10,000 cartridges. Each cartridge, in turn, contained enough data for a lifetime of perusal. Scientific treatises and bureaucratic memoranda and schematics detailed to a microscopic level. Jin hadn't known what to imagine when her father and Bodhi had talked about the data vault, but it hadn't been this. Not a library too vast to comprehend. Not a monument to imperial atrocities grander than anything she'd ever encountered. Every book Jin's father had ever read to her, every history of every planet she'd ever visited, could have fit on one of those tapes. And every one of them held some dark secret of the Empire. The vault shaft proper was divided from a control room by a broad glass viewport. Cassian suppressed his awe and his vertigo faster than Jin and headed straight for the main console. Jin shivered at the icy air, like a refrigeration unit or a morgue. She followed Cassian and tried to think of worse places to die.
Schematics bank.
K2's voice announced through the console.
Data tower 2.
How do I find that?
Cassian asked.
Searching.
K2 replied.
I can locate the tape, but you'll need the handles for extraction.
Handles? Jin scanned the console, spotted a bewildering set of mechanical manipulators. Cassian looked equally nonplussed.
What are we supposed to do with these?
Jin leaned over the console, propping herself with a knee and peering through the viewport into the upper reaches of the vault. Cassian doffed his officer's cap and tugged off his gloves before fumbling with the manipulators. Once he began, Jin spotted a mechanical arm rising rapidly through the tower, turning to one bank of tapes after the next.
Figure it out fast, she muttered, and slid back to the control room floor. There's a whole fleet waiting on us.
Schematics bank,
Cassian muttered.
Data tower 2.
Servos whined loudly and metal roared. Jin turned in time to see the vault door clamp shut. The air seemed more frigid than before. K2's voice came through the comm only faintly, as if he were speaking at a distance.
The rebels! They went over there!
Jin remembered the droid's awkward, unconvincing dissembling in the Holy Quarter on Jeddah.
Damn! Had the Imperials found them? If they were trapped now, everything happening outside would be for nothing.
K2?
Cassian grimaced, looking from the manipulator controls to the comm.
What's going on out there?
The comm growled with indecipherable static. Jin saw something new flash across Cassian's expression. He was afraid. Not intellectually afraid. Not afraid of failing the mission. But afraid for K2. Afraid for his friend.
Keep moving the arm,
she murmured, and searched the console for a readout. She tapped a key and found it. A registry of cartridges in each bank.
You fly, I'll navigate.
Cassian's grip visibly tensed as they heard a series of noises very much like blaster shots. Was this hope? Facing fear after fear for oneself and for friends and for the galaxy? All out of some desperate need to accomplish the impossible? Maybe, Jin thought, she'd been better off without it.
If you were alive, Papa, I'd have a lot to blame you for. Hyperspace tracking. She read off the screen as the arm whirred about the tower. Navigational systems. Deep core cartography. The vault was arranged by subject, clearly. Beyond that, she hadn't a clue how to search. Maybe there was an index somewhere, but Saw Gerrera's training hadn't prepared her to serve as a data librarian.
Two screens down,
K2's voice announced, as if he'd never stopped speaking. Cassian parted his lips, and Jin raised a hand, silenced him, and urged him back to the controls. The catalog scrolled rapidly on her screen as the arm kept moving.
Structural engineering. Open that.
K2! Cassian snapped. The arm stationed itself at a cartridge bank.
Tell me what's happening!
Jin's screen switched to a listing of tapes, once again organized in no fashion she could discern. Maybe they had identification tags she wasn't seeing. Or maybe it was yet another layer of security. Hard to rob the vault if you couldn't find what you were looking for.
My riot control protocols are now active, but the situation is well in hand?
Jin winced at the self-conscious lie of a question. There was nothing she could do from the control room.
She spoke sternly, demanding Cassian's attention as she read from the screen. Project codenames, Stellosphere, Mark Omega, Pax Aurora.
Were all of them weapons like the Death Star? Designed for terror and genocide?
Had her father known about the others? She couldn't afford to think about it. There were too many horrors down that road. War Mantle, Cluster Prism, Black Saber.
And she stopped. The next name stood out with burning intensity. So obvious, she might have found it by touch.
What?
Cassian asked. Stardust, Jin said.
It's that one. How do you know that?
Curiosity and urgency mixed in his voice as if he wanted to say, be sure. Jin was sure.
I know, because it's me.
Cassian looked at her with astonishment. Then he turned back to the console, gripped the controls fiercely.
Kay, we need the file for Stardust!
The comm was full of noise, inchoate and intermixed, like a war zone filtered through a downpour. No sound came through the solid vault door. The arm, already stationed at its proper data bank, maneuvered among the cartridges and reached out needfully.
Stardust,
K2 said, and Jin heard strain in the droid's voice. Cassian still clutched the handles. Jin couldn't tell whether Cassian or K2SO was performing the final maneuver.
That's it, she said. You almost have it!
The arm's manipulator closed around the cartridge and pulled. Then the lights at the control room went out, leaving the console, Cassian, and Jin, illuminated only by the sinister red glow of the vault shaft through the viewport. The refrigerated air pricked at Jin's skin, arousing goose flesh down her arms and spine. The comm didn't stop its static shrieking until a moment and an eternity later, it did.
Kay!
Cassian screamed into the silence, hunched over the console. Jin stared up at the rigid arm, clinging to its data cartridge high above. In the artificial midnight of the control room, the tower shaft seemed very much like a cave. K2SO's reprogramming by Cassian Andor had stripped the droid of certain ineffable qualities. He remembered, as if at a great distance, a sort of conviction that had come with serving the Galactic Empire. He remembered, too, the pride and confidence that had come with fulfilling exactly the duties he was designed for, with knowing that every servo motor and every processing cycle contributed to enforcing his Imperial Master's edicts. Cassian had denied him that exquisite sense of purpose and replaced it with individuality. With individuality came doubt and cynicism, an awareness not only of the odds of success or failure, but of those outcomes' repercussions. Cassian had killed K2SO, whose true designation was far longer and far grander, rich with meaning and history
that described his factory of origin, the date and time of his initialization, and more, and brought him back both smaller and larger than he had been. K2SO did not mourn for his old self, but there were times he grew wistful over what he had been. When the first stormtroopers had entered the antechamber to the data vault, K2SO had suppressed his hard-coded obedience instinct, forced himself to attempt deceit, to little effect, despite having watched Cassian lie masterfully time and again, and finally resorted to activating his enforcement protocols. He had severed his connection to the console while leaving the comm open, and, after eliminating his opponent through force and a superbly aimed blaster bolt, spent 27 milliseconds considering whether to return to the console at all. K2SO was not a data pilot. He was not an astromech unit. The joyful rush of utilizing long-neglected skills was, in its way, intoxicating. He could have abandoned Cassian and Jin to proceed with further enforcement. He chose not to. During this initial skirmish, K2SO also suffered damage to the carboplast composite casing of his midsection. The blaster shot itself did not harm anything vital, but the heat of the burnt casing melted a length of interior wiring. He rerouted his functions and continued. He had attempted to comfort Cassian when his master asked for an update. The particular dissemblance was, on reflection, a poor use of resources. It diverted K2SO's attention from an increasingly variable combat situation, as well as his attempt to locate the Death Star technical schematics. As additional stormtroopers entered the antechamber, K2SO had deactivated his self-preservation warnings, maintained his connection to the console, and savored the pleasures of wielding a personal energy weapon. At that time, he also took several additional blaster shots to non-vital sections of his chassis. Rerouting his functions was becoming more difficult. After this, two equally unavoidable complications arose nearly simultaneously. First, a stormtrooper. K2SO identified her as TK-4012, but resisted the urge to download her Citadel personnel file. Fired a blaster bolt that impacted just over 4 centimeters off K2SO's programming port access door, a normally non-vital area through which K2SO had rerouted multiple vital functions. The irony was not lost on him. He estimated he now had well over 12 seconds before a cascade failure resulted in his permanent deactivation. Second, another stormtrooper, unidentified, fired a poorly aimed burst that delivered multiple particle bolts into the control console. Despite the Citadel's unusually redundant systems, K2SO found himself unable to access various vault mechanisms. With approximately 12 seconds until total shutdown, K2SO considered his options while Cassian screamed his name. He loosely projected 89 ways to prolong his own existence, for periods ranging from 0.8 milliseconds to 43 days, suspecting all of them would involve the capture or execution of Cassian Andor and Jyn Erso, he dismissed them without detailed study. He re-examined his mission parameters and projected only 2 ways that Cassian and Jyn might retrieve their desired data cartridge and escape Scarif. Upon refinement, both appeared infinitesimally unlikely. K2SO re-examined his parameters a second time, at a cost of several milliseconds, and deprioritized the survival of Cassian Andor and Jyn Erso. He actively denied himself any opportunity to mourn or reflect. He chose to eschew further loose projections and estimations in favor of detailed simulations and hypotheticals. He began with this premise. Cassian and Jyn now had the opportunity to manually recover the data cartridge. With approximately 9 seconds until total shutdown, K2SO activated his vocoder assembly and spoke into the comm.
Climb!
Retrieving the cartridge was not sufficient for mission success. The Death Star technical schematics needed to be relayed to Rebel agents off Scarif. this would be difficult, so long as Cassian and Jin were trapped. K2SO had no way to free them. He made internal inquiries. Could the data be transmitted to the rebellion directly? The amount of data stored on a single cartridge was vast. Secure transmission to Yavin 4 was out of the question, under even ideal circumstances. These circumstances were not ideal, but a communication system was available.
Climb the tower!
He did not take conscious note of the blaster bolts blazing around him.
Send the plans to the fleet!
Even the Citadel's communications tower could not transmit an entire data cartridge with a shield gate in place. But Cassian had already taken measures through Bodhi Rook to open the gate. Had Cassian foreseen the scenario?
If they open the shield gate!
K2SO's protocol systems endowed his words with extreme emphasis.
You can broadcast from the tower!
With approximately 3 seconds until total shutdown, K2SO listened to Cassian's voice cry his name one last time. Then, without regret, the droid turned his weapon on the console. The comm cut out. With the controls now reduced to a melted plastoid metal compound, the stormtroopers would have considerable difficulty entering the vault. With 1 second left until total shutdown, K2SO chose to mentally simulate an impossible scenario in which Cassian Andor escaped alive. The simulation pleased him.
Supplemental data. Sunset prayer.
Document number JPO-103. Sunset prayer of the Guardians of the Wills. Recovered from the outskirts of Nee Jeddah. Provenance uncertain.
In darkness, cold. In light, cold. The old sun brings no heat, but there is heat in breath and life. In life, there is the Force. In the Force, there is life. And the Force is eternal.
Chapter 20. Krennic tried to focus on Galen Erso's communications archive. He scrolled through endless memoranda and dispatches while General Ramda's men shouted updates and orders across the command center. There was nothing Krennic could do for the stormtroopers on the beach, or for Admiral Gorin's fleet. Nothing but dig for the truth of Galen's treachery among engineering personnel transfer requests and complaints about thermal exhaust ports. Galen had set this in motion. If he had reached out to allies in the rebellion, sent the traitorous pilot to contact those allies on Jeddah, summoned those allies to Edu, arranged for them to hound Krennic even after Galen was rotting in a mudhole of a mass grave. Krennic stopped short. He remembered now, on the Edu platform, a flash of dark hair and a face covered in ashes. He recalled the voice saying, "You'll never win." But it was Lyra who spoke, not Galen.
Unauthorized access at the data vault!
His attention left his console, snapped into crisp focus on one of Ramda's lieutenants.
What? It's just come in, sir.
The lieutenant's head twitched to one side, as if he were seeking support. No one came to his aid.
There's a security team already in place, but no details about the intruders. We're waiting for more now.
Krennic shut out the man's nattering. The rebels were inside the Citadel. They were inside the vault. They were determined to steal the schematics, to find an imaginary weakness, no matter how many lives they lost. They were determined to haunt him on Galen's behalf. And Ramda wasn't up to the task. The shield gate was shut, and escape was surely impossible. Yet too many impossibilities had already occurred for one day. He hurled his words behind him as he marched toward the stairs.
Send my guard squadron to the battle! 2 men with me!
There was someone in his way. He roughly shoved the body to one side, not bothering to identify the man's face.
And get that beach under control!
He didn't wait for acknowledgement. As he emerged from the command center, two death troopers fell into step behind him, and he thought of another day long before. Another planetfall, another squad of troopers, and another danger to his life spawned by Galen. That day on Lamu had ended in victory too. Orson Krennic was going to war. Tonk was dead. Bodhi hadn't seen it happen. He'd crouched low to shuffle half a pace forward along a sheltering wall of cargo crates, and when he'd looked up and across the landing pad, he'd spied the soldier motionless on the ground. He fought down the urge to rush to Tonk's side, to yell for aid from the rebels who still survived. There was nothing he could do. People were dying all around, and the stormtroopers kept coming. A blaster bolt crackled over Bodhi's head, close enough for him to feel the heat and smell the ozone of vaporized atmosphere. He smoothed the cable on the ground with one hand and looked helplessly toward the shuttle.
Bodhi, are you there?
Bodhi snatched the comm link from his pocket. Cassian's voice sounded hoarse.
Talk to me!
I'm here, Bodhi said. I'm here. I'm pinned down. I can't get to the ship. I can't plug in. He didn't mean to sound desperate, but what was the point of lying? The situation was bad. It wasn't his fault, but it was bad.
You have to!
Bodhi had heard Cassian angry, heard him determined, but this was something new, almost pained.
We need the fleet, Bodhi. You have to get a message out!
Are you okay? A thought too awful to dwell on crossed Bodhi's mind. Is Jin okay?
We're fine,
Cassian snapped. For a moment, Bodhi heard only long, ragged breaths. Then Cassian seemed steady.
We're changing tactics. We're not sure. We may not make it back for extraction, but we can try to transmit the schematics from the comm tower.
Bodhi wanted to argue. What exactly did "we may not make it back" mean? But Cassian kept talking.
That's a lot of information, Cassian said. And even the tower won't be able to push it through the shield without data loss. Tell me I'm right about this, Bodhi.
Bodhi forced himself to concentrate. Audio was one thing, but sending a data cartridge through the shield would be like trying to broadcast it across the galaxy. Too much data, too much interference. You're right, he said. You're right.
So you need to let the fleet know,
Cassian said.
They need to get in position to receive, because I doubt we'll get two shots. And they need to hit that gate. If the shield's open, we can send the plans.
What about you? What about Jin? But Cassian sounded ready to crack under the strain, and Bodhi couldn't bring himself to keep the man on the line. All right, he wheezed. I'll find a way. He roughly pocketed his link and looked toward the shuttle again. The barrage of blaster fire wasn't stopping, wasn't even slowing. Tonk's soldiers weren't winning. Maybe, Bodhi thought, if FaZe and Chirrut returned to the landing pad. But no, he'd already sent them to the master switch. How long did he have before the pad was overrun? Don't talk yourself out of it. Just go! His first stride almost sent him sprawling as he went from a crouch to a barreling run. He caught himself and kept going. Listened to the cable hiss and writhe behind him as it trailed from the spool on his back. Saw flash after flash of crimson scorch the air between him and the shuttle. A bolt struck the undercarriage of the vessel as he approached, dropped the burning spark between his forehead and his work goggles. He ignored the distraction and the pain and climbed the ramp, dashed across the cabin to a terminal. He fumbled at the spool with sweat-slick hands, wrested the cable free, and plugged it into the socket. The terminal registered the connection. Bodhi screamed in triumph, ignoring the warning light that indicated the ship's computer couldn't find the comm tower. Baze and Chirrut and Melshi's team would get to the master switch soon. Bodhi would tell the fleet about their new strategy. And when Cassian and Jin were atop the tower, transmitting the tape, he'd swoop in and find them like he had on Edu. And they'd all make for the open shield gate together. That was the plan. That was his plan. He hoped Tonk would approve. He hoped his comrades could work fast. How long now before the pad was overrun? Cassian's hands were trembling, but his eyes were steady as he lowered his comlink. Bodhi's working on the fleet. He'll get it done. The vault control room remained dark, save for the red glow of the shaft. The refrigerated air was heating rapidly and filling with a sharp metallic stench. Jin could hear the muffled hiss of plasma torches on the far side of the sealed vault door. We may not make it back. She'd heard Cassian say the words to Bodhi, but not to her. She craned her neck and looked up the shaft, up the center of the Citadel Tower. Her father's data tape was there. Somewhere, beyond the red glow, there was also a way out. "Step back," she said, and gestured Cassian away from the viewport. She drew a pistol, took steady aim with both hands, and fired into the glass. Jagged shards, melting and blackened, exploded onto the console and down into the vault shaft. They rang like wind chimes. Jin stepped forward to study the broken pane, then began stripping off the helmet, bulky chest piece, and heavy overclothes of her security uniform. She was long past the point of disguises, and she didn't need extra weight during the climb. Cassian followed her lead, pulling off his officer's jacket. When she had stripped down to vest and pants, Jin scanned the shaft for grips. Data cartridge extraction handles protruded at regular intervals, and the stacked data banks jutted with slender metal flanges. It wouldn't be an easy climb, but she decided against shedding her boots for extra traction. She remembered one very long night after leaving Saw that had ended in bloody soles, broken toenails, and a valuable lesson about proper footwear. "Come on," she said. "Before it all closes in," she nearly added. But Cassian didn't see the cave walls. She mounted the console, bent her knees, and leapt across the gap to the nearest data tower. She caught a set of cartridge handles and scrambled to find footholds. After an instant, she felt the cartridges shaking under her hands and feared she might pull them loose. But it was only the vibration of the data banks themselves, rattling with the mechanisms that cooled and cataloged the tapes. She climbed the meter, testing the force she could apply to the tapes and feeling out the distance between them. She looked down into the yawning darkness in time to see Cassian leap tentatively out of the control room. He too caught hold. Jin looked back up, fixed the retrieval arm in her sights, and began ascending in earnest. She heard Cassian struggling behind her over the noise of recirculating air. She knew she should have said something more to him. "I'm sorry about K2, or we might still get off Scarif, or we're going to finish this." But she'd never been much good at commiseration or encouragement, and she'd spent so many words on the Alliance counselors, on the rebel soldiers in the past days. She didn't have the strength to spare for him, just the drive to haul herself up one row of cartridges at a time, drag herself away from the darkness and toward the hope of light. She counted 15 rows to the retrieval arm, then 10. She glimpsed a doorway in the shaft wall. Secure maintenance access, she imagined, but she wrote it off as a means of escape. The Empire had to be watching. 5 rows more. Her shoulders began to ache, and her wrists felt stiff from trying to grip the cartridges without yanking them free. The sounds of Cassian's climb were receding below, but she couldn't wait for him. 1 row. Then she was perched beside the retrieval arm. It grasped the Stardust cartridge like a dead miser. The cartridge was unlabeled, no different from any other. No different from the thousands surrounding her, except that her father had given his life to reveal it. She wedged a boot against the stack for leverage, set a free hand on the handle of Mark Omega or Pax Aurora or Heartchopper or whatever ghastly thing the Empire's scientists had thought up, and tugged at Stardust in the hand of the machine. The frozen arm clung tight. Then she jerked the tape away, and the arm bobbed loosely in the air. "I've got it!"
She cried.
And she did. She had it. She had it. And she squeezed it and brought it close enough to smell the metal over the cold, dry air. However else she'd failed, however many deaths, saw her father, the girl on Jedha, the droid who'd sacrificed himself, were her fault. She'd come this far. She was ready to shout obscenities at the universe, defiant imprecations against fate and the Force and the Empire. Then her boot slipped, and she scrambled, one-handed, to regain her holds.
Careful!
Cassian shouted from below, and she was grinning fiercely as she panted.
You okay?
He called. She didn't answer. She was already climbing again, the cartridge safely hooked on her belt. The surge of triumphant, exultant energy faded as swiftly as it had come, leaving Jin with only an urgent need to escape the dark. Her arms began to tremble with the strain of the ascent, her muscles recalling the agonizing climb up the landing platform on Edu. Through the gloom, she made out a warm, blinking light high above, an aperture at the top of the tower, pulsing open and closed, barely wide enough to cast shadows. Close. So close. Then she heard another shout beneath her, fury mixed with alarm and Cassian's voice as he cried her name. Jin dropped a hand and twisted just in time for a flash of crimson to obscure her vision, to spark against the stack of databanks and leave a mass of melted polymer where her cartridge handhold had been, standing in the maintenance entrance were three figures out of a familiar nightmare, the man in white and his stormtroopers in black. They had seemed impossible on Edu, so much so she'd nearly forgotten them in the aftermath, written them off as an exaggeration, a trick of an exhausted mind, wrapping a figment from her past around a sliver of reality. Now they'd return to send her plummeting into madness. The man in white looked up. She wanted to scream. Instead, she swallowed the sound like she had when her mother died. She wanted to freeze, to hide inside herself, and drop away from the databanks. And if she did, Stardust, the cartridge against her hip, would be buried in her cave, along with her own remains. She tore her gaze from the man in white and looked back up the shaft. Captivated by dream logic, knowing it was untrue, she thought, if I make it to the light, I can escape forever. Climb! Crimson burst around Jin as she swung on the cartridges, trying to rotate herself to the far side of the data stack and find cover from her attackers. She caught a glimpse of Cassian attempting to do the same, but he was slower, and he'd drawn his own pistol, firing wildly at the doorway. One shot landed miraculously, sending a black-clad figure over the edge and into the depths. The fall dragged her further into reality. Whatever they were, whoever the men in black and white were, they were people and not dreams. They could die, and so could she. The Imperials targeted only Cassian now. He swung desperately toward cover, as sparks spilled off metal all around him. Jin started to call to him, but he cried out louder.
Keep going! Keep going!
She reached a trembling hand toward her pistol. She could die. So could they. She knew she had to climb. The decision was taken from her. The second stormtrooper took a hit as a bolt flashed toward Cassian. Trooper and spy fell together. Jin couldn't tell whether Cassian had been struck or if he'd simply lost his grip, but he plunged out of view without a scream or a word. She nearly loosed her clutching fingers, nearly followed him into the abyss. But a swell of vertigo shocked her out of her horror and impelled her to cling more tightly to the stack. Cassian was dead, like so many others. So many taken by the man in white. She had to escape. Climb! Scarif was burning. Dueling starfighters sent cannon fire and torn metal raining onto the beaches.
The mountainous corpses of Imperial walkers bled smoke that shrouded whole swaths of jungle. Reinforcements delivered by rebel U-wings had replaced the fallen with new soldiers, and these were cut down in turn by newly arrived stormtroopers in black, men and women who moved with the sober calm of executioners, picking off their foes one by one. Baze Malbus waded through the inferno in silence, untouched by fear or grief or particle bolts. He followed Melshi and Chirrut, trusting them to see to the mission, and guarded lives where he could. He snapped off swift, precise shots, downing too many stormtroopers to count. He felt no responsibility for the allies he could not save. He had made no oaths, promised safety to no one. He failed to stop a stormtrooper from ambushing a dark-haired woman and leaving her dying in the shallow tide. He failed to drag a sniper his own age out of view of a strafing TIE fighter. He had spilled more blood in a day than he had thought possible. And though his generator hummed warningly and his muscles felt stiff as dried leather, he was ready to fight on. He would endure through the night if need be, if that was what Jyn Erso required. And if the mission failed, if there was redemption to be found through killing, he had surely already found it. But he would fight on nonetheless. Melshi's tattered platoon was running toward the citadel on its quest for Bodhi's master switch. Just within the outer perimeter, Melshi promised, was a bunker complex containing what they sought. Baze did not know why the switch was important. Something about the rebel fleet. But as he hurried beside his comrades on the beach, he grimly marveled that the fate of planets might be altered by such a trivial thing. A U-wing was toppling from the sky. It hit sand, a stone's throw ahead of the rebels, sending a shockwave along the ground and plowing a deep trench. Mud and fire splashed as metal ruptured and wailed. As the rebels approached, a salvo of blaster bolts tore through the wreckage and the flames, through gaps in the burning metal. Baze spotted more of the black-clad stormtroopers closing in. He loosed a barrage of cannon fire that did little good. The stormtroopers crept low to the ground, eliminating their targets slowly and certainly, as Melshi waved his people frantically toward the bunker complex. The soldiers sprinted away from the water and the wreckage, exposed and vulnerable. One rebel fell, then another. Chirrut leapt between the troopers' bolts as if their passing pushed him aside. But his fortune was not others' fortune. Baze vaulted over more than one corpse, turned back to spray cannon blasts at the troopers, then raced into the shadow of the citadel tower. He saw Melshi attempt to haul an ally to safety and take a bolt to the side for his troubles. Stinking badly of melted fabric and burnt flesh, Melshi hobbled with Baze into the relative shelter of the squat bunker. Only four warriors remained. Chirrut stood near the front of the Spartan bunker with Baze, panting and leaning lightly on his staff. A broad sniper, someone had called him Cephla, took pot shots at the troopers through the bunker's narrow embrasures as the enemy formed a perimeter. Melshi struggled to stay upright in the far corner. There might have been other survivors scattered across the battlefield. Or Baze, Chirrut, Cephla, and Melshi might have been the last. An urgent voice issued from Melshi's comlink.
Melshi, come in, please! Anybody out there? Rogue One! Rogue One! Anybody!
Chirrut raised his ornate light bow, firing at the stormtroopers as they forced Cephla down and into cover. The stormtroopers adjusted and targeted Chirrut. Baze replaced Chirrut, as Chirrut had replaced Cephla, who now prepared to replace Baze. Together, Baze thought, they could hold off the Imperials for several minutes, likely no longer.
They've got the plans!
The comm spoke with Bodhi's voice, mixing triumph and terror.
I'm tied in at my end, but I can't hold out forever. We lost Tonk.
The troopers had established a broad circle around the bunker and the adjoining equipment. Consoles and charging stations and signal relays. Baze snarled in satisfaction.
She has the plans!
As he fired a shot that took a man off his feet, then jerked back his head as his foes returned to volley.
Rogue One! Can anyone hear me out there? I've got my end tied in. I need an open line.
Hang on!
Melshi gasped and tossed his comlink to the ground before beckoning to Baze. He stank of death. Baze crossed to his side and let Chirrut and Sephla take up the slaying work.
Be quick,
Baze said. Melshi nodded, his eyes wide and glittering.
The master switch, he said. It's out there, at that console.
He raised a trembling finger and pointed into the kill zone. The workstation was 10 meters away, far beyond reach. Before anyone could react, Sephla was out of the bunker, dashing toward the console, pumping arms and legs as sweat dripped down his back. He moved with brisk, brave certainty. He died in an instant, cut down by a dozen particle bolts, accomplishing nothing. Baze looked back to Melshi. He had slumped to the ground beside his comlink.
Maybe it would have been better, Baze thought, to be killed by the walkers.
To die cowering in sight of an unachievable victory was a humiliation. Maybe death always was. Baze raised his cannon. Perhaps there were other survivors. Perhaps if he downed enough troopers, reinforcements might reach Bodhi's master switch. A final slaughter was all he could offer Jyn Erso and the dead of Jetta. All he could offer to torment the Empire one last time. But before Baze could fire, Chirrut rose from the bunker and stepped into sunlight. Chirrut Imwe felt the warmth of an alien star in his skin and a sea breeze pawing at his robes. The heel of his staff dug into hard-packed sand. Beneath the odors of conflagration and death was the perfume of jungle flowers and the sweet stink of dirt beetles. Beyond the electric snap of blaster bolts, he heard a high-pitched chittering, the noise of a beast he had never encountered. To this cacophony, he added his voice.
I am one with the Force, and the Force is with me.
Whatever Chirrut had become in his life, and without the temple, he could not truly be a guardian of the wills. Without joy and frivolity, he could not be a clown and jokester among sober peers. Without the Holy City, he could not be a protector of his beloved world. Whatever he was not a warrior at heart, and the events of the day had eroded his spirit. While Baze, his brother and ward, had embraced his role with vicious resolve, Chirrut had fought and run and killed because fighting and running and killing were necessary. Now they were necessary no longer. And he was glad.
I am one with the Force, he said again. And the Force is with me.
The words echoed inside him.
I am one with the Force, and the Force is with me. Baze yelled his name from the bunker. Chirrut did not stop.
He felt hot bolts whip past him, heard leather gloves squeeze metal triggers, and turned his body as if shouldering his way through a crowd. He tapped the heel of his staff, feeling his way toward the console by the traces of buried cables. He listened for telltale echoes where the noise of the battle resounded off terminals and equipment. He did all this without thinking. The art of Zamashiwo, the inward eye of the outward hand, attuned his breathing and heartbeat to his chant. It was his chant that guided his motions, controlled his pace as he strode forward.
I am one with the Force, and the Force is with me. Chirrut!
Baze called.
Come back!
Baze was terrified. Chirrut was not. In the instant before he'd risen from the bunker, he'd questioned his own wisdom. How might he separate the will of the Force from his will, his ego? Demanding action where action was unneeded. But there was no doubt in his heart now. The Force expressed itself through simplicity, and all it asked of him was to walk.
I am one with the Force, and the Force is with me.
His staff wrapped metal. The sight of a console. The chant guided him to its front, and he glided his fingers across buttons and readouts. He touched a broad hinged handle recessed in the console. A master switch, if ever there'd been one. A particle bolt reverberated centimeters from Chirrut's left ear as he urged the switch forward and felt it lock into place.
I am one with the Force, and the Force is with me.
He smiled softly and thought of Bodhi, the strange pilot who smelled of Jedha beneath his Imperial suit. Chirrut's chant was faltering now. With the switch activated, his path had become obscured. He listened to the storm of blaster fire and heard Baze's voice again.
Chirrut! Come here!
So he turned toward Baze and the bunker and began retracing his steps. The rhythm of his breath was off, and the thousand noises and odors and sensations all about him failed to coalesce. Each tugged at him, insisted on his exclusive attention. Then there was only one noise, a terrible thunder like the world splitting open. He was driven forward as pain flashed through his old bones, and every injury he'd ever suffered ignited. Somehow, as Chirrut impacted the dirt and rolled to one side, he was aware of Baze shouting his name again. He couldn't feel his staff. He couldn't feel his hand, except for a terrible throbbing and its numb weight at the end of his arm. But the art of Zamashiro had much to say about controlling pain, and Chirrut permitted his blood to spill without experiencing suffering. The violence inflicted upon his body troubled him less than the violence he had inflicted upon others. He was dying, of course. He felt Baze's heavy familiar tread pound the ground, smelled his brother's sweat as he leaned close. He wanted to say, "Baze, my eyes, I can't see." But Baze Malbus had always needed comfort more than humor.
"Chirrut," Baze murmured. "Don't go. Don't go. I'm here."
He wondered for a moment how Baze had crossed the battlefield to reach him. But of course, the Force had reunited them before the end. Baze's calloused fingers rubbed life into the back of Chirrut's hand.
"It's okay," Chirrut said. "It's okay. Look for the Force, and you will always find me."
He tried to smile, but he was no longer sure he could. The words of the chant echoed and shivered Imwe's heart once more before he died.
"I am one with the Force, and the Force is with me."
The stormtroopers were closing around the cargo shuttle. Bodhi could tell because, not infrequently, a particle bolt would blaze up the boarding ramp and impact the interior bulkhead, raining sparks onto the floor. Bodhi didn't know how many of Tonk's people were still alive, fighting desperately to hold their foes back, nor did he know whether at any moment someone might sever the cable snaking up the ramp to the communications console. He was almost out of time, and all he could think was, "I'm sorry, everyone. Sorry for promising what I couldn't deliver. Sorry for not coming up with a better plan." He'd tried. That counted for something, didn't it? When the console readouts updated to indicate a connection between the ship and the Scarif communications tower, he wanted to weep with joy. Instead, he hunched over the unit, adjusted his frequencies, and prayed someone would hear him.
"Okay, okay," he began.
"This is Rogue One calling the Rebel fleet."
He heard only the soft hiss of static in reply. They didn't even know he was trying to reach them. They were fighting for their lives, and he was broadcasting aimlessly, as if some bridge officer was going to notice and pick up mid-battle.
"This is Rogue One calling any Alliance ships that can hear me!"
He fought back the tremor in his voice.
"Is there anybody up there? This is Rogue One!"
"I did my part," he told himself. "I got a signal out. I'm sorry if no one was listening."
He thought of Jin, of Cassian, of Baze and Chirrut and Tonk. He wondered if any of them would be capable of forgiving his failures. Galen had forgiven him, at least. Galen had understood the need for forgiveness better than anyone.
"This is Rogue One!"
Specks of spittle dotted the console. He wiped them away with his sleeve.
Come in! Over!
This is Admiral Raddus aboard the Profundity!
The comm came to life with a roar.
Rogue One, we hear you!
Cody uttered a laugh that might have been mistaken for a